Here we are, back on the main course. It's Sunday, so it's the main course. I'm Patrick.
You're Patrick. I'm Katie, and this is the Heritage Radio Network.
We're here in Roberta's restaurant on a lovely Sunday, although it seemed a little stormy at the beginning.
It's really hot and humid, just the way I like it. Hazy, hot, and humid in New York City.
I
think it's, if you want to do the TechServe promo, I think it's button number 5,
nice.
Because that's our sponsor today.
All right, here it goes. Is everyone ready?
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe. www.techserve.com.
We're back.
I worry about TechServe, because now don't they have the Macintosh stores themselves? With all their experts?
Oh, they most definitely do, but I think TechServe is holding its own because they're not brand specific. Right? Don't they do different brands?
No, they just do Mac.
They just do Mac?
100%. So for them, this would symbolize the Macintosh stores.
I think it's the only place to go for computer repair and Apple accessories.
Yeah, they're very nice. They have that old Coke machine. So yeah, they're really nice to sponsor the network. Well, this is an exciting day at Heritage Radio Network.
Because it's 100 degrees out, or rather in the studio.
It's kind of hot. First of all, it's Heather's birthday. Heather Hyman, who's important
birthday,
to mail
Heather
order.
Heather Hyman.
She is, I think, 17, 18?
Yeah, something like that.
Anyway, she is awesome, and she helps. She saves our butt all the time at Heritage, and she was like one of the first producers, and I maintain like the best tagger.
Yeah.
She tags our website really well.
Yeah. So anyway, we have kind of a fun show today lined up for our listeners. We have Gabe.
Who's Gabe?
Gabe is the guy right next to me who's pouring a beer. God
nice.
Bless him. He's going to pass it around. It's Gabriel Peter Giampietro.
Macken.
Okay, that was a mouthful, Gabe. And how come it's Giampietro and it's Peter? I think you made that up. I think you were pulling our leg.
I absolutely did not make that up. That is my real name.
Did your mother, when she would get mad at you, be like, Gabriel, Peter, Giampietro, McCagan?
No.
Like, that's like
no.
When they
it was
say
mostly
whole...
Gabriel. She would also call me Gordon, though. She was the oldest of 11, and Gordon was her youngest brother. And so sometimes we would get confused.
Can we go with Gordo? Yeah. For the rest of the show.
Oh, yeah, because he's so gorgeous.
I don't know.
But Gabe, you are one of the cooks here at Roberta's Restaurant.
I am indeed.
Turning out the fine dining experiences. Tell us, you guys have the garden upstairs here on top of our shipping container, but there's also another space where you cultivate your own vegetables. Where
we
is
do.
That?
That's on Central Avenue, maybe 5 or 6 blocks away.
How much space do you have there?
Oh, square footage-wise?
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. There's a... Let's say it's about 30 by 30, and it's all boxed, 2 foot deep, sort of soil mixed containers that we're growing in. Growing lots and lots of different things. Greens, fennel, beans, beets, watermelon, lots and lots of stuff.
Corn?
No corn.
I just had my first corn of the season.
The world has enough corn. I'm sorry.
Oh, like,
the
world
so
has enough
good when it's on
it's
the
really
crop.
Difficult to grow and get a good yield out of.
Yeah.
Especially if we're trying to put it into a restaurant. Like we can grow in maybe 8 square feet. We can grow how many corn plants?
Yeah.
We go through that in 10 minutes in the restaurant.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's why local corn is probably the domain of the Midwest, you know, more than it is, you know, urban gardens. But we have a minute to go in our introduction. Also a guest is Jennifer Klepper. Is that right?
Yep.
From Fatty Crab. Is that pronounced correctly?
Yes, it's Fatty Crab.
Awesome. Well, I'm a big fan of Fatty Crab. And you run the mothership. I mean, the original, which for years and years and years was how the world knew of Fatty Crab. Now there's some expansion happening, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So well, I can't wait to talk about the cuisine and how unique your food is. And then we also have Jean Hodish. Hey, Jean.
Hey, how's it going?
What are you going to talk to us about today?
I'm going
to
talk to you about my newsletter, Local Gourmands.
Is it a printed newsletter?
No,
it's an email. An e-newsletter, yes.
It's good
lovely.
For the environment. We have a sound effect for that.
Exactly. Oh, good. I'm so glad.
So we are going to take a break and cut to some lovely music, and then
we'll
come
be
back.
Right
yeah.
What's the next song?
The one about me.
Oh, yeah.
says. Like Jimmy says.
With Patrick Martins. I'm Katie Kiefer. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We are in the studio today with Gabe McMacken and Jennifer
Gordo.
Jennifer.
I've been called many things, but never Klepper, Gordo.
From the Fatty Crab. And Gabe is from Roberta's. And we have Jean Hodesh from Local Gourmands. And what am I forgetting? We are sponsored by TechServe. Thank you.
Sorry.
Very good. Okay, so we were talking to Gabe a little bit about the gardening here and what distinguishes Roberta's, I think, from many other restaurants. And I was wondering if Fatty Crab has any access to growing their own vegetables, Jennifer. Is that just something you can do when you're out in the wilds of Bushwick and with a shipping container in the backyard?
Can I buy your watermelons?
Right? I think you'd be through with our watermelons in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, there isn't enough watermelon in the world for us. Or pork belly.
Why is that? How come you need so much watermelon? Do you make a watermelon pickle?
We pickle the rind, actually, but we use the entire fruit. We use the flesh for our pickled watermelon and crispy pork belly salad. And we pickle the rind, and the skin we throw out.
Uh-huh.
But it's a lot of watermelon. We sell a lot of crispy pork.
And wow. It's delicious.
Well, thank you.
How many orders do you go through, like on a busy night? How many people might order that dish?
3/4 of them.
Really?
How many seats?
I think we're at 45 right now with our outdoor seating.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
What was the genesis of that salad?
You know, I'm not really sure off the top of my head, but I don't really know. No one's ever asked me that before.
Well, have we identified the cuisine of Fatty Crab?
It's Malaysian street food.
Street food.
Yeah.
So that was the genesis of that. But I didn't know that watermelons grew in
I think watermelons grow any place there and it's warm enough to grow.
And is that right?
There's enough room
I almost think
them.
It is a very North American fruit because, like, when I've lived in Europe, I don't remember ever seeing it in Europe.
I'm not sure.
Like
Europe
in France
has the weather
or Italy.
For it.
They also don't have cranberries in Italy.
No, they don't, but that's uniquely American.
My ex-brother-in-law was like coming home with cases of cranberries, trying to convince the bartenders to open up a distribution line. Vodka and cranberry doesn't exist. Anyway, there's some fruits that don't go everywhere, I guess.
Huh.
Well, yeah, you can't really get mangosteen in this country unless it's frozen, and it's not very good. But watermelon, I would think, is anywhere it's warm enough, like Texas or Malaysia.
And we don't have bananas, but we have the pawpaw, which is like the American custard apple, which has some banana qualities to it.
Oh, yeah. They got a lot of that stuff over there.
And there's some sort of a kiwi variety that grows around here, too.
Really?
Yeah. It's a small, I think it's a vine, grows in trellises, maybe the size of a golf ball.
Hmm.
I think I may have seen those in the store.
I'm not familiar with that. So did you go to Malaysia? Did you have to go to Malaysia to check out the street food? How'd you know what to do?
I learned while I was there. I would love to go if anyone wants to sponsor my trip to Malaysia and Singapore.
You mean the Fatty Crab hasn't offered yet?
No, but I take donations because I would love to go.
Fatty Crab, any ideas? Sorry, it looks like you're going to have to fund it yourself.
Poop.
And how would you define the Malaysian cuisine? I mean, there's a certain, fish kind of base to a lot of the dishes, like that adds a real kind of gusto to the taste.
That's actually fermented shrimp, Patrick.
It is?
Yeah. Lots and lots of krill.
And that goes how into so many dishes?
Well, there's fermented shrimp that actually get hand culled, like they bring them in nets and they pick through them and get the tiniest ones and kind of pack them together in like these round discs or in like blocks, and they wrap them in paper and they ferment them underground.
Wow.
Yeah, and then we slice it and toast it and put it in as much
as we can.
Is that
what they call shrimp paste?
It goes by a lot of names depending on where you are in the world. Uh-huh. But we call it blashan or love.
Huh. Because I have a cookbook called The Cradle of Flavor by James Osland. And
really?
He has some, yeah, it's a lovely book. And he has a lot of recipes where you take like shrimp paste and you toast it in a foil packet.
That's the stuff.
Yeah. So it must be the same stuff. But I guess I didn't read how they made it. I didn't realize it was.
I read it in
it
a book.
It was buried underground.
Taste
now, that
of
reminds
Southeast
me
Asia.
Of the Icelandic culture has a shark. Fermented shark that's buried into. I'm sure you all saw that episode with No Reservations with Tony Bourdain,
yep.
where he pronounced it the worst thing he had ever eaten, which I guess is saying something for him. Although the shit-filled intestine that gave him gave him some really raunchy disease, that must have been a close second.
Sounds good.
Yep. Well, Zach, I'll say one thing. I mean, Fatty Crab was Zach Palacio's one of his first restaurants. And what I always liked about him is that he understands that, like, a lot of these Asian businesses downtown can do certain things better than he could ever do it at his restaurant. So he actually supports those businesses. I mean, does he do that with the shrimp, dried shrimp as well, or is that done in-house?
We actually buy that product, but the thing with shrimp paste is the shrimp paste that we get is a product that's made only for export, mm-hmm. and the actual blashan that is used in Malaysia is a much better product, and the ambassador to Singapore and Malaysia will sometimes bring us some when he comes to visit.
Wow.
It's a much, much more subtle product. It's really, really good.
How does Malaysian food differ from other cuisines in Southeast Asia like that, that are, you know, sort of, that are part of that cradle of flavor, that Indonesia, you know, that whole big swath of territory, and they all have quite individual characteristics. What do you think defines the characteristics of Malaysian food versus other Indonesian or
Well, a lot
Thai?
Of that whole area is kind of a big melting pot because a lot of people move around from place to place because the islands are so close together. I think that Malaysia has a lot of Chinese influence from Malacca, a lot of people from Hainan. The men moved to Malaysia and took Malaysian wives. They're called Nonya. That's where we get a lot of our cuisine from. We pull a lot of influence from Thailand as well. Like a lot of the green, like herby flavors that we use are definitely
right,
Thai.
Like the basil and the mint and all that stuff. Do you
yeah.
use a lot of that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Do you use a lot of peanuts, too?
Yes, a lot of peanuts. Uh-huh. Lots of peanuts.
Oh, my God, the Rwandan women
Oh, my
are
God,
here.
Our Rwandan women.
This
oh, how
is for
beautiful.
Our next show.
Oh, man.
Oh, my God.
Nice outfit.
It's going to be the best show of all time.
Come on now. This is the best show.
This is the best show. Patrick, pull yourself together.
Has anyone been to Rwanda? You guys haven't even been to Rwanda. How could you claim that this is the best
show? We haven't even been to Malaysia yet. We're just finding that out.
Still working on the funding for Malaysia.
Where did you read? Where did you read this? What resources do you use, Jennifer, to do your research?
I read a lot of cookbooks from the office at work. Uh-huh. I take them home and never bring them back.
Uh-huh.
One of my favorites is Singapore Heritage Food. I don't remember who wrote it.
Well, there's a lawsuit right there.
Yeah, sorry. Whoever wrote that book, you're awesome.
I'm just kidding.
We'll have to find out and tag it and send it to them.
I think it's Sylvia. I don't know. Sylvia something. I'll try and find it.
Now, Gabe, could you do Malaysian food here? I mean, what are the rules of Roberta's?
You want to swap?
No, I'm saying not. I'm saying, do they say stick to Italian? Or how does. What
is
the
cuisine? How much flexibility
here?
Do you have?
We have a lot of flexibility. But we all sort of kind of concentrate on simple, direct food and flavors that are within the Italian palate, mm-hmm. the Mediterranean palate maybe. But we'll do things that are maybe more French or maybe just a little bit more playful. Like we have a pizza on the menu right now that is called the Cortez, but
so good.
It's delicious.
I haven't had the Cortez.
It's ridiculous.
Which
it's
one
like
is
a
that?
Taco.
Oh, really?
It's a really, really crispy
I like
base.
I the Beastmaster.
Also
I think that's a
good.
Really crazy.
The Cortez
crazy
is truly unlike all their other pizzas.
Really?
Yeah, you almost think you're at a different pizza place.
Oh, I think, yeah.
I think we had
I
a slice,
maybe. No, Sarah was offering it to me last week, and somehow I missed it, mm-hmm. but anyway.
So one of the pizza guys here,
so we'll have one later.
Angelo, who's from Santa Fe,
right.
got this chili pepper, this ground chili, from one of his friends that came to visit. And it is so fragrant and so powerful. He mixes it with Patrick's pork.
Yay.
Ta-da. And so he makes this great sausage.
Sound effect.
It's a fennel sausage with some of this pepper, and then radishes and cilantro and crema, and it's ridiculous. Sweet. It's really, really good. Worth the watering. Trip, as the Michelin people say.
Well, that is a good sign, because we can eat that pizza thanks to TechServe, who's one of our sponsors. It's important that we have sponsors, so hold on.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by TechServe. www.techserve.com.
Pretty awesome. So, and how's it been going? I mean, are you guys full all the time here? Or?
We're pretty much full all the time. We had a great review in the New York Times recently about the food that we do in the back kitchen. I mean, the pizza is
phenomenal. And
that's a
relatively new phenomenon for you guys, because you started out with just the wood-burning stove, right?
Right.
Or the wood-burning oven.
And we were cooking on Sternos in the back until about April. And
Amazing.
Then we got the gas hooked up, and then we started really, really cranking.
I can't imagine cooking on a Sterno. Can you, Jennifer?
Yes.
Really?
How big? Have you seen the Fatty Crab Kitchen?
Never. How big
you
is
should stop
your
by.
Sterno? I will, now that I know you. I'm definitely going to.
Let me know.
I mean, because I mean, I was in the catering business for years. So for me, a Sterno is a little thing like this, and you're lucky if it, you know, jacks up enough heat to, you know, keep your
simmer.
Your soggy home fries soggy, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's got to be a challenge to actually produce real food on that.
Actually,
can you bring water to a boil?
Well, you can bring beer to a simmer.
Okay.
Is
on
it
a camp
important
stove.
That it bring, gets that brought to a boil? Like pasta, what if it's almost boiling?
Does Harold McGee wrote an article about that recently.
Oh, I missed what that. What a shame. I always wondered.
Well, he said, I mean, it's you're putting moisture into the pasta.
Yes.
You're putting moisture. You're hydrating, basically. And it if you're at 212, it doesn't necessarily matter if it's boiling. I mean, if you're at 195, you're still going to get the same effect.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, why, though? I thought the reason that it had to be boiling was that it sort of opened the pores, like it shocked open the pores of the pasta product and allowed the moisture to go in. And that's why if you had it at lower than a boil, the pasta would go in and it would just kind of glue over.
Do you also believe that this is a landing zone for Pegasus and stuff?
I
need a tinfoil hat. I wish I remember the article better, but
I'm gonna look it up, man.
It's not. He's saying it's. People think about it a lot, like they think about, you know, blanching vegetables. Blanching vegetables. It's really, really important to have that really high temperature and hold it. You know, big pot blanching. But pasta is a little bit different, especially dried pasta. You're not gonna get the same sort of separation if you don't have agitation in the water. Mm-hmm. But you don't need it to have it in the hugest rolling boil.
Right.
You want it. But
well, most commercial, I mean, most home stoves are not going to give you a huge rolling boil anyway once you put the pasta in, unless you let it cook forever, right?
So back to the original point, then probably the Sterno works. I mean, originally here, there was no gas, no nothing. And
you guys were making pasta? Oh, yeah.
The pasta early on, to be honest, was like, would make you think that the boil was necessary. Like, sometimes it was too raw, but I'll say that was the hardest food to make is a simple pasta, you know?
Oh,
and so I think that in their first couple of weeks, you know, that was a tough nut to crack. But now the pasta is the maltagliata
The maltagliata right now with a rabbit ragu that we cook with some red wine and, white wine, tomato, olives, and some parsley in that. It's
that sounds
phenomenal.
Very, very nice.
So back to the original thing, they were cooking with like a Sterno or something like that, and Carlo would say that he was the ideal person to invite camping because he could cook for 300 people.
Yeah,
no
that's
problem.
Right, on a Sterno, yeah. let's switch gears for just a second, you guys, since I have you two culinary geniuses here. One of the things I notice about what's happening in the food industry, especially sort of the quote unquote food revolution, is, you know, I've been looking at food for such a long time. I see this huge pendulum swing back towards meat, and I think it's kind of interesting that it's, I mean, heritage meats like Patrick's, but just in general, menus have really made kind of a change, don't you think, in the last like 3 years or so? Don't you find it a much more sort of
away from fish or away from what toward meat? How do you
mean towards more interesting preparations of meat, using meat in more different ways instead of just having like a steak or a chop on your menu. You have like a ragu, you have a this, you
well
have
so
that.
Using the whole animal is really, really important.
When
you know,
do
you,
think you that
get a
start?
Whole you get a whole lamb,
yeah,
what percent of that is actually, you know, your
loin
prime
lamb
cuts.
Chops. Yeah, not so many. Yeah.
So you take the whole lamb and you use the shoulder, you use the rack, you use the shanks, you use the tongue, you use the brain. You use absolutely everything that you
can. I thought you weren't allowed to use brain.
Shh. We're not using the brain.
You just have to call it ain.
You call it sweetbreads.
Or bra. Yeah.
But the, you know,
but you better know where your lamb is
but
going.
Do you think
from.
It's important? Do you think it's the chef's responsibility to try to become a whole animal institution? You know, a whole animal.
Yeah, I
restaurant?
Think that's asking a lot. I mean, what about for you, Jennifer? You use a lot of fish in your menu, obviously.
I don't
so.
Think it's asking too much. I think that it given either. Given the right platform, given
but
the right environment,
you have to have enough money to have the personnel to process all of those bits and pieces.
And if you have such a successful watermelon and pork belly, hey, listen, the people love it. What can you do? You
yeah,
need
should
more
you
bellies.
Then have to buy a whole pig so that you can make your watermelon
well,
and pork belly?
You build me a pig made out of bellies?
Genetically modify a pig.
Well, yes.
We're probably not too far away from that.
I think that idea.
That's terrifying.
That's yeah.
They're easier to chop, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm sorry,
using
I
missed that. A square watermelon?
Oh, yeah.
Also, we're trying to get fish that comes
they
already
breaded.
They
could grow breaded. Them in a box, though. That would
already filleted. They come in bags. They do exist.
Having the opportunity to do a whole animal is a beautiful thing.
Yeah,
we don't have
true.
In our environment, in our kitchen right here, really a platform where we can do whole animals. We
right.
would love to, but people don't necessarily come here for that experience.
You can come mm-hmm. and visit if you want. Because sometimes we get whole animals. Usually we get a couple and we split them up between our different
but,
locations.
Because you have more than one restaurant.
Yeah, there's we share between three of us.
Uh-huh.
We
so
were,
it's Fatty
we're
Crab 1,
that.
Fatty Crab 2.
Yeah.
And what
77th
else?
And Cabrito? Downtown. Yeah, and Cabrito.
Uh-huh.
Dave likes a lot of shoulder.
Uh-huh.
So
I like
built
Dave.
Him a shoulder pig. I like Dave too. His
He's
birthday's
awesome.
Next week.
Oh yeah, it's Heather's birthday today and Dave's birthday next week. Are you guys doing a party?
I think Tina's throwing him a party, yes.
We're at their house in Greenpoint?
I believe so, yes.
I'm going to try to get invited to that.
I'll invite you.
Awesome.
I bet it won't be hard for you, Patrick.
Yeah,
well,
I'm sure
you never
show
know.
Up.
Patrick is
I
like
can
a
be
human
annoying.
Satellite. No, he just knows way, way, way many people.
We have 2 minutes to go. So
we do?
We no, nothing can start right now with the phrase, as a small child.
Okay.
Because that's too long a trajectory. But so let me ask, what is the price point of your two restaurants, just to give people a perspective? Roberta's is at 261 Moore Street in Brooklyn, and Fatty Crab is 643 Hudson?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my God. My brain
You're
is
really
so
sick.
Wasted.
You are so twisted,
I remember
man.
Random phone numbers, too, all the time.
I do that, too.
Yeah, actually,
are,
phone
though.
Numbers, I can still remember from when I was like 4 and 5 years old.
But I remember using. No songs, so whereas most kids
or
of
jokes.
My generation
I don't
have.
Remember jokes.
Well, I did hear a joke. Actually, Walter Cronkite told this joke. He says, you want to hear a joke?
Yeah.
Two Irishmen walk out of a bar. It could happen.
Got a chuckle out of me the first time in almost a second.
Almost a second. Yeah, it's so quick. You got
it's so quick. But like I said, it's a joke that you could actually remember if you don't have that facility.
So what is the price point? If a couple comes in and has like one of your great beers or a glass of wine each and a hearty meal, what would they pay?
You know, I would probably say like $35 a person.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be pretty fair, but why stop there?
Yeah, well, Fatty Crab is unusual is that you can't spend $35, but you could also spend
right,
$200.
You could spend $35 a person, or you could spend, yeah, like $200 a person. Depends yeah. how
and
long
it wouldn't be
you
any worse
chair.
For the experience. Like,
no, not at all.
That high
how
quality.
Come street food is so expensive?
Because the streets of New York City are expensive.
And so $35 is not expensive.
I don't think that's bad at all.
$35 is very inexpensive in a
yeah,
lot of ways.
Reasonable.
If you consider the memories and the pleasure and the talking points the next day, that's absolutely worth it.
It's priceless.
It really is.
Let's face
kind
it.
Of.
And Gabe,
no, I was
tell
just
us
curious.
About.
I mean, oh, sorry. Go
well,
ahead.
And, well, we have 10 seconds there, but tell us.
Again,
here.
It's a huge range. You can come in here and you can get a pizza for $11
mm-hmm.
or less. You can come in here and also get an incredible dry aged ribeye
mm-hmm.
For. A substantial amount more, you can get a phenomenal bottle of wine. We have a lot of different stuff to offer, but you know, we're trying to provide a value for people and make it accessible.
Well, we are going to take a quick break and turn the AC on because on our next show we have six
dripping.
Rwandan
yeah.
drummers. They're going to need all the air we can give them. But this has been very interesting.
Well,
we have another
these,
20 minute segment.
Are they coming back with us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we will be right back. And guys, can we cut to the Beyonce song? If she sues us, I'll pay for it. No? All right. It's such a good song.
And we're back. It's Heritage Radio Network. This is The Main Course with
Patrick Martins.
And I'm Katie Kiefer. And we had a great show today. We have in the studio with us, we have Gabe McMacken.
No, it's Gabriel Peter Giampietro McMacken.
Thank you. Yeah, it's such a mouthful. And much simpler, Jennifer Klepper from Jake Fatty Crab. Yep. And we have Jean Hodesh from Local Gourmands, a newsletter that we'll be talking about later on in this segment. But we were just actually, while we were off the air just now, Jennifer and Gabe were talking about making yuzu pepper, which just sounded so cool. So let's, if you don't mind rolling back the tape just a second on that little conversation, let's talk, what is that? What you use, you said you use it all the time and you buy it. Can you describe what the flavor is and what makes it so groovy and why it is, you know, so ubiquitous, I guess, in Malaysian cuisine?
I don't think it's ubiquitous to Malaysian cuisine. It's just I think it's Japanese and it's tasty.
And you love it.
Yeah,
it's really good. Incorporate it into your Malaysian dishes.
Yeah, it showed up in the restaurant one day and we used it and decided to keep using it.
Uh-huh.
It's really all that happened.
So are you making up a lot of your recipes? You're just riffing on the themes, right?
You know, a lot of the, I kind of inherited the menu and I've stuck to it because it's good. And I don't really want to change it. But we've added a few things that Zach and I have worked on. Or that I've come up with and he just really likes.
Things including yuzu pepper.
Things including yuzu pepper with those shrimp roll things.
Right.
Yeah. So, I like that things don't change at certain places.
You know, you go for that thing.
And I think as a chef, it's the challenge to maintain such a high standard with so little of margin of error all the time. Like, you don't have to do that for 40 years, but... It is a very technical-based cuisine, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of labor. It's a lot of hand counting, and you know, we make all our own curry paste and stuff like that. I know a lot of people buy that stuff in a jar. It's not very good. It's better when you make it yourself.
It's not that hard to make yourself either. I mean, I do a lot of Indian and Pakistani cuisine. You just have to have the if you have your pantry together.
You need a Roboku.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah, pounding by hand in a mortar and pestle is not as much fun as a Roboku.
Well, not when you're making it for 300 people a night, but if you're just making it for two, mortar and pestle works great.
Oh, yeah, it's texturally pleasing, but...
Yes, and it gets out a lot of aggression.
Oh, yeah, unless you break the poundy thing.
There's nothing like pulverizing, yeah.
Yeah, oops.
Oh. Oh, my slip is showing.
So, Gabe, what is the most challenging work... oriented thing, the labor intensive thing you do back there in the kitchen?
What's the most labor intensive?
I mean, even if it's not preparing the food, like what's the toughest thing to do each week or month?
I don't know. Everything is kind of a pleasure. Everything is very simple and straightforward and direct. You know, we let things taste like what they are. Some things go into cure for a little while, some things don't. All of our preparations are very rustic.
How does the oven play into the final dish, like with the meats and stuff?
The wood-burning oven? There are a few things that we do in the wood-burning oven that are really, really tremendous. We do a pork chop in the wood-burning oven. It's heritage pork.
Those are good chops.
They're really, really good chops.
Yeah.
So we brine those for at least 24 hours, and then we take them out of brine, season them really well, and then put them in the wood-burning oven. And the oven runs between 850 and 950. Depending on what location, I think that's correct. I'm not
positive. That's what the guy. I was actually Gene and I were talking to the pizza chef today about the temperature and how different spots do actually produce different amounts of heat. I was also wondering about humidity too, like in terms of, you know, if it's in a different spot in the oven, is there a different level of humidity if it's in a cooler spot than if it's in a...
There is so much heat in that oven that I doubt that there's any humidity, which is actually one of the really big really big challenges about making bread. And we have a pretty phenomenal bread program right here right now and are constantly evolving it. But to make bread without moisture and to keep it light and aerated is a real challenge. And we've come a really long way.
Recently. Old ovens, when you go to like, you know, some Neanderthal or what, I don't even know what part of the world, of the timeline it was, but when they made ovens, they had communal ovens and it was a wood-fired oven and they made bread then. Didn't that bread rise? Yep. Wasn't that pretty?
Well, we have a sourdough. We do it. I mean, it's just in modern bread making, people use steam ovens.
You don't squirt? Yeah. Do you squirt? You squirt into your oven? No.
Is it true that the Jews use unleavened bread just because they were in a rush once and they had to like get the hell out of there?
That's what I've heard. They didn't have time to let it rise.
But the wood-burning oven adds, imparts an incredible flavor on the pork chop. And we put the pork chop in on a, you know, on a sizzle platter or on a pan, depending on who's doing it and what they're feeling, and just let it be itself. Mm-hmm. Right now, we're garnishing it with Anson Mills Farrow. What is it? Collard greens from our garden, and it's just a phenomenal, phenomenal dish. Mm-hmm. Really, really nice. We do a wood oven roasted chicken right now. That's also brined, gets rubbed with rosemary and garlic and lemon, and it takes the flavor of the wood really, really nicely. Mm-hmm. And fish.
And the wood comes from where?
I don't know. I forget.
Be interesting to track it because I'm sure that imparts a flavor.
It does. It's very specific. We have a constant supply of wood, and I don't. I wish I remembered where it was from.
Well, let's have that guy here or girl, whoever raises it or harvests it, I guess. You would say
conjures it.
Yeah, conjures it.
Conjures
it
from the void.
Are you going to tell me your alchemy story now?
I am not going to share that with you.
Are you
going
to try to convert me to? I can make gold
in a wood burning oven.
Yes,
we're really doing it right now. Even back then, I'm sure. Like if we were transported back and didn't know anything we knew about science, I'm like, I can make gold, dude. Invest in me. We'd be like, nah. That doesn't sound very
probable. But plenty of people did.
I know. Well, they would now, too. I just don't think I would have ever invested any time.
Yeah, I think they were called, mortgage-backed securities. I can make gold out of nothing. Yeah, right.
Oh, my God. So, and how many purveyors do each of your restaurants have to deal with on a weekly basis?
Oh, let's see. As many as we want to. I mean, we go to the market for a lot of our stuff. We deal with you guys at Heritage. We get our fish from Peerless.
Okay.
We deal with a farm cooperative in Pennsylvania to get a lot of our stuff. And we get our dairy from Lancaster County Farm Fresh. But we also deal with a lot of small purveyors around here. There's a farm in Bushwick called Boswick Farms that Lee Mandel runs, and he's a very small hydroponic operation where he's mostly doing peppers and basil, and we love to be able to bring his stuff in. Mm-hmm. We deal with Rooftop Farms. Ben Flanner has brought us some incredible stuff. Michael Grady Robertson at Queens County Farm Museum has brought us incredible things. So we're trying to bring as many people that are growing things or raising things that are close by into the restaurant and to really share with people what it is that they're doing and what we can produce in this environment and what has traditionally been produced in this environment too is, I think, really, really valuable.
Right.
You know, we were talking about the price point and talking about bringing people in and sort of building the community here a second ago before the break, but it's also really important to give people a historical context for where this food has come from and what actually is from here.
I mean, that's an interesting thing, although, I mean, I'll say one, we have a common colleague, Michael Batterberry, who, you know, does that New American Farmer Project with mm-hmm. Gus Schumacher,
yes.
I think.
Yes.
And I mean, just complicates things a little bit. He's talking about getting families from like Malaysia or Vietnam who, you know, aren't happy there to come here and give them farms that Americans don't want to continue. And they, of course, are interested in growing traditional things that are in the same latitude or something like that. But so, I mean, you know, and then also on the genetic level, you know, purebred genetics, like if you didn't cross things,
we would die out.
Exactly. You know?
Yeah,
there's got to be a little dirty.
Yeah, there has to be a little bit of.
And if you think about it, the Italians are so into their wines. I mean, with that blight that they had, those are all American vines, you know? I mean, but you're not supposed to say that. But and then their tomato comes from North America, you know.
Yes.
So whose is what's, like, Ferran Adrià is opening a now pizza place, restaurant.
Yeah. He has Fast Good or Good Fast.
He's trying
burger
to
burger joint.
Is that what it's called?
There's a place called Good Fast. I forget what it is. There's a shelf stable egg that he developed.
Huh.
Yeah.
Really?
It's crazy.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Well,
we're gonna have some food chemists on.
We have Wiley Dufresne
and Dave Arnold from FCI are going to come on in a couple of weeks.
Exciting.
So, but I want to backtrack just for a second to what you were talking about, Gabe, about the using as much of the sort of within 350-mile radius of New York City, and one of the guests that we had on a few months ago is a guy named Steve Schmoller down in Cleveland, and he started a project called Land Crop. And what they do is, he, because to tie into the sort of how many suppliers do you have to call, he tied all of his small farms, all the guys that he was working with, into a delivery system, a distribution system with Cisco. So
really,
yeah,
that was called Chef X
with Cisco.
Chef X.
That may be a similar program.
Well, but by him, with Cisco.
That was his first foray into this. That okay. was a that's it a, was a dairy co-op a up in Vermont, partner. Actually, is yeah. what he did then. Well, Steve has worked on both sides of the aisle, if you'll excuse the thing. He's both done restaurant chef, but he's also done food development for big companies like Carnation, so or Nestle, I should say. And so that's how he got involved in knowing people from Cisco, and he has created this incredible network of farms and small producers in the Cleveland area who are all served by Cisco, and then all of these restaurants buy into it. And he's created an online marketplace. And, I mean...
Is he leveraging the distribution network that Cisco has set up in order to move between
exactly.
things? That's wild. Yeah, I wouldn't imagine that they would buy into that.
Oh, no, they totally
on
did.
On a
because
simple really level that means did. That they stop by... places that they didn't used to normally stop,
right.
even if it's a very small load.
Right. Yeah,
you know? And the thing is what was he got this going when the fuel prices were skyrocketing and the Cisco trucks were circulating half empty or empty.
Wow.
And so that's what inspired Cisco to participate. And by the way, U.S. Foods, another huge distributor, is also linking up regional networks of farmers. And I'm not aware of that happening here in New York City, but I cannot imagine why we can't make it happen.
There actually is a group called Basis Farm to Chef. I've met with them a couple times, yep. and what they do is they have a link with a bunch of farmers through New Jersey and Pennsylvania and New York. And are they in Vermont, too? I think they're getting something.
I think that they are
they
in
might
Vermont,
have some
too.
Dairy.
But also, that's Dixon's Farmstead Meats. I mean, Jake Dixon is doing the same sort of a thing. He's pulling from a lot of different people and bringing it down.
And
but
because the biggest problem is distribution,
products,
right? I mean, that
having
is the biggest problem.
Having that infrastructure
problem.
is incredible.
Because you can grow the greatest stuff in the world, you can be a chef with the best intentions, but how many phone calls a week can you make, you know, to all these different producers?
I find ironic how we've been more cut off from our own state than we have from, like, the Midwest commodity farming areas.
Well, in a way, building a city, you're removing yourself from the land. You know, you're removing yourself from an ability to produce food. And there are some cities, like I think Amsterdam has put in green belts where you know you have to have in a certain way when cities are developing, you have to have certain green space. You have to have farmland within a certain area, and New York City just doesn't have it. When Brooklyn was booming, when Brooklyn was being developed in the 19th century, there were farms here that were just leveled. You know,
Well, there are farms in Upper Manhattan, same thing.
Absolutely.
Although there is a solution maybe in urban farming in these empty lots, plus suburban farming.
Yes.
Expanding it to the suburban area, we could probably feed ourselves, I would predict.
We could, but the issue is the distribution. How do we move the food around? And to me, that's
Dairy
the
land.
Piece of the puzzle.
Well, no, I hate to say, no, she's right. She's absolutely right. I mean, listen,
Dairyland will do
I mean, you're a distributor, Patrick, so
well,
you know what we're talking
there's
about
probably,
here.
I would guess, 30 million. This could be off by like up to 15 million. I would predict that there's 30 million meat-based meals consumed in the five boroughs of New York a day.
Right.
Call it 50, maybe total 30 of that, let's call 20 million meals. That's the game. You know, it's not, I mean, no offense to the guy growing, you know, a single Gloucester Old Spot in Westchester. Like, that is very important also, but like, who wears Purdue? Like, what's that battleground? And so I think the protein supply will forever be a, you know, I'm always interested to hear more about like a Nyman Ranch. Growing or like that seems to
be like somebody who has mastered the distribution issue and who has figured out how to plug that into the mainstream.
Well, but then Nyman also takes farms, small farms, all over the country and links them together.
Right.
And that's what people, well, say Roberta's, we have different sites and we're growing. We're taking on different lots and different people's backyards and we're growing.
Yeah,
and
that's
people
the
like
answer.
BK Farms. I forget the URL, but they're doing growing on a small level in different places. If you give them your backyard, they'll grow food.
I think
they'll
that's the answer about how to move it. It's just so local.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many hundreds of city-sponsored yards or gardens that are allowed to sell to schools.
So that each, sell to schools, but what about all the
hospitals.
Other institutions? And, I mean, you know, to me, I don't see the city, I mean, like, you can develop all these great vegetable plots, but if you can't figure out a way to get those vegetables from point well, remember, A to the central receiving area, where they then go out to the multiple myriad institutional kitchens.
But look at Bette Midler, for instance, who I'm really hoping we're writing her a letter to see if she would be a guest. But apparently the city was selling all these lots, you know. So, of course, the traditional guys are there. They're not taking it seriously. They didn't even show up, that many of them.
Wow.
And sure enough, Bette Midler buys up like 40 lots and turns them all into gardens. I kind of sense a city being willing to change their distribution or purchasing rules to allow a school to be eating the tomatoes from there. So super local on the fruits and vegetables.
And schools growing them themselves, too. Yep. There's, exactly.
There's a lot of movement in that direction, absolutely.
Automotive High in Williamsburg, they have a tremendous program that they're growing a lot of their own food. Well, not a lot of their own food, but they're growing food and showing kids how to grow.
Yeah, I think they do that quite in Red Hook,
projects
too.
Like that.
Sorry?
I think they do that in Red Hook, too, actually.
Added value.
There's added value, right.
Added value actually just got a huge new space on Governor's Island. They're growing
that's
in
great.
There, too.
Good
yeah.
for them. That's
they're
great.
Doing tremendous stuff. And their mission is a lot of education. And they've gotten great grants to support it and develop that program. They're just doing really, really tremendous stuff.
Well, Gabriel, Peter, John, Pietro, McMacken, Jennifer Klepper, this has been great. I mean, you guys are going to stay on, but on our next segment, we're going to bring in Gene Hodesh to
chat about what's going on in the food world.
We have a sound
effect. In the five borough area.
We have a sound effect for what's
going on.
This
girl has got it plugged in, man.
Oh, wait. I really meant to do this one.
Patrick.
Main course. It's Sunday. We're at Roberta's. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. And today we have Gene Hodesh with us in the studio. Gene, among her many other activities, runs a little newsletter called Local Gourmands, which I was lucky enough to get hooked into a few weeks ago. And I have enjoyed receiving it pretty much every Monday since, when was that? Back in May or April?
Yeah.
May. Yeah. Because Gene was nice enough to come to my cooking lesson.
Which was great fun. It was fantastic.
Did you learn anything?
I did. I learned how to, they were cutting up
was
part of
chicken. Was that our chicken? That
yeah.
was our chicken class,
which was great,
yeah.
Because I've never done that before, I'll admit. So it was really helpful information.
Do you find yourself ordering whole chickens aloud at restaurants? You're like, I'll cut it myself.
Yes, I know exactly where that leg joint meets the frame of the body. I know where that little piece of cartilage is to split the leg from the thigh.
So what was the genesis of your newsletter?
So I had an internship at Sevier Magazine. I was working as a fact checker. And I worked at art magazines to
during
begin
with. During what era of Sevier?
This was in the fall of 2007. So
okay,
not that long
so
ago.
Very recently.
So Todd Coleman was there and James Osland was running it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nice crew.
Really nice crew.
Yeah.
She's great. She was doing web stuff. I don't think she's there anymore. But really nice small group of people who worked really hard. So I was working there for about 2 months, sort of before I went on a trip to Senegal and Morocco. And I kind of went to just travel around for 5 weeks. And I came back and I was looking for a job and I wanted to do something with food and specifically with local food. And it was the middle of the winter. So I was just trying to kind of go out and network and meet people. And so I would go out to, you know, book readings and to different sort of cocktail hours where people were talking about local food in the city. And suddenly I realized that there were all these different events happening each week. And at the events, I would meet people who shared the same interest. And so then I started, you know, I would email seven people at a time and say, oh, there's, you know, this talk happening at this bookstore on Thursday night.
Gene, you seem to be like plugged in now because you, I mean,
well, now it's grown. Now people tell me what's going on.
I don't see anywhere else. I mean, for instance, over 4th of July weekend, I don't know how many people knew that Tom Mylan was hosting a pig roast
at Queens
at the farm. And you could go and spend the night and camp out at Queens Family Farm. I mean, I didn't, who knew? I didn't see that anywhere else. So that was when I really got interested in the newsletter and started paying a lot of attention to it. And then all the beer things that happened this month, because this is the beer month.
This is beer month.
Well,
that's
beer
right.
Things happening so, Wednesday.
Big Wednesday party.
Big Wednesday party.
You got to come.
That's, is that the edibles thing?
That's the edibles thing.
Yeah. How do you, who are your sources? Like, are you like a cop? You know, do you have one of those unmarked cars?
Are you staking out magazine offices?
How do you do it? I mean, do you offices? Just talk to 100 people a week on the phone or via email?
I talk a lot on email. I have about 40 websites that I visit maybe on Sundays. I try to pull together the newsletter on Sunday so it can go out on Monday. And just different things. You know, sometimes the yard has great parties on Sundays, and every now and then they'll have a big barbecue, so I'll list that. The edibles have parties, events going on periodically. I always check the Green Market website to see what they're up to.
Do you go like apeshit if you don't get like the corner story? Like if they tell someone else first? You're like, went to the Times? You went to Marion Burroughs?
That's right. Kim Severson? Or me, Florence Fabricant, and you didn't tell me?
I feel like, I mean, the events that I list are definitely, I find them, either I hear about them or I find them on other people's websites, and I just kind of pull them together, you know? And now, recently, people have been sending me sort of press releases, which I find hilarious, because, you know, it's run out of a Gmail account. It's like, really, but I have, you know, 200, 250 people on the list, which is like,
that's
you know,
very respectable.
That's legit.
Yeah.
It's bigger than a lot of small towns.
Yeah.
August 26th, hot tip, edible trivia. Roberta's backyard.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Send the information to Gene.
Let's east ask a question just so people know. I'll start off. Which Medici is credited with introducing the fork into England and France in like the, I forget, 15th century?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, this is food trivia.
Oh.
It's what he just said, food trivia. Oh. Which Medici was it?
Okay. It was Catherine.
Yes. Very good. Katie's like, I knew her, actually.
I'm old enough. I'm the only person in the room, I think, who's...
Gabe, give an example of it. What's a good food question? Test us.
What glands are sweetbreads?
Oh!
Good one.
She was a butcher and I run Heritage. Well, you go.
Yeah, the thymus gland, of course.
Oh.
Yeah. What? You look disappointed, Patrick.
No, I'm looking for a sound effect. You are kicking ass.
Well, I mean, you know, come on. I did work in a butcher shop. That does make a difference.
Ask us a trivia question about food.
Gene. Oh, God. Food trivia?
Yeah,
seriously?
Sure. Yeah.
I don't know what to ask you. You all know way more than I do.
She's
asked,
answered two of them.
Well, restaurants or anything, any kind of trivia that's related to food. Food and community.
Food and community.
Oh, now so we're getting to
it. Put me on the spot.
We're in Brooklyn,
there.
Right? This is all right here.
Let me I have ask a you question this. You could ask. Okay. How many subscribers, how many people are on your list? 250. Mm-hmm. All right. Now you go. Do you have a food trivia for the people out there? Like, how do you pickle pig belly or something like that?
How do you make shrimp paste?
Oh,
that's a good trivia question. Good trivia
how do you
question.
Make that yuzu pepper that
that's
you guys come on? That's what
hours.
We, yeah.
How do we make yuzu pepper?
Yeah.
Okay.
We didn't roll the tape back far enough.
How is that?
So, yuzu pepper, the line I have to yuzu pepper is a friend who's a chef in Japan. And she describes it as this process of pickling, preserving peppers, and then.
What kind of peppers? Wait, let's.
I don't know.
Let's backtrack.
That's the big question.
What kind of peppers? Yeah, because are these like here. Little chilies or are they like green bell pepper? I doubt it.
I wish I knew.
I don't think it's anything that's really hot. I mean,
I don't think of the Japanese.
We need
as
a sound
a
effect for this. Wah, wah, wah. You guys, the question of the hour. You get to the next step.
Okay, so edible trivia. Edible trivia, August 26th. It's a Wednesday night. Come at 7. If you know how to make yuzu pepper,
you get a $100 gift certificate at Roberta's.
If you can make your, you can make, I wish I could say that.
If you can make yuzu
coming
pepper
out of Patrick
that passes
Martin's
Jennifer's
pocket.
Muster.
If you Jennifer can make your own yuzu pepper, bring it. I'll give you a back rub or something. I don't know.
Okay. What if I don't want to be touched and I just want a pizza?
You get that too. I'll buy you a pizza.
I'm off on Wednesday.
Okay.
Awesome. Well, this has been a great, great show. This might have been the most fun show.
I think so, yeah.
I like the idea of everyone in it together from the beginning.
Yeah, I do too. Everyone's in this format. Too. I think we're getting somewhere.
They're starting to roll. Yeah. This means an email.
Yeah.
This is a good show. Well, thanks, guys.
Thank you, everybody, for coming on to the show. This has been terrific, and we hope you'll all come back sometime.
We experienced flow today, which Csikszentmihalyi defined as the exact meeting point between anxiety and boredom.
Uh-huh.
You're not bored, but you're not anxious.
You're not anxious.
Who is it that said fear is excitement without the breath?
Fear is excitement without the breath.
Very nice.
Yeah, I'm going to have to be pondering that one.
We have Plutarch over here ending the show. Cool.
Bye-bye.